The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2,000-mile border between the U.S. and Mexico zigs and zags through several states and into the heart of American politics. Anxiety about immigration has raised walls in some spots to keep Central American migrants out, except where the Rio Grande narrows to a pinch in South Texas. There, a team of Mexican firefighters known as the Diablos is regularly invited in.
The reason we need the Diablos is because of our remote nature. They're all very good firefighters.
That's Richie Sinkovitz, an engine captain at Big Bend National Park and crew boss of Los Diablos, Mexican nationals who chase flames across the borders. Richie's our guest today, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So what's the Los Diablos origin story? How did they start fighting fires in Texas?
So back in 1990, some of the rangers at Big Bend, there's a history of having difficulty getting resources to that part of Texas. It's a very remote location. And some of the rangers started training some of the guys from the small town hamlet of Boquillas as wildland firefighters. It's just so they could respond to when there was a large fire in the park and you needed some, you know, a hand crew of firefighters to work the fire. If you didn't have those guys right there, you're generally waiting like at least a day or two at the minimum for other resources to arrive to that area.
I've been to Big Bend. It's huge. How big exactly?
I think it's around 900,000 acres.
Well, here's a little clip from a video that The Atlantic made about Los Diablos, here talking about the origins of the name. It is in Spanish.
Y el nombre de Los Diablos nació porque nosotros dijimos, si nos das el trabajo, nosotros trabajamos como diablos. De ahí agarró el nombre que ahora tenemos.
Well, we just wanted to give listeners a sense of one of the crew. What is the origin of the name Los Diablos?
All right, so that was Gabriel Ureste, and he was talking about they told the park managers that if you give us work, we'll work like devils. So and that's where the name came from.
Now, there are 32 Mexican nationals on the team. Were they hired as experienced firefighters, or were they all trained?
Well, you know, they all went through the basic training to be a wildland firefighter, which is more or less just like a 40-hour class. But, you know, they're all very experienced firefighters at this point. You know, the least experienced firefighter started, I believe, in 1997. So, and some of the originals are still there from 1990.
So help me understand, of course, the Rio Grande is a natural border between Texas and Mexico, also an international border. Can they cross at will over the border?
Not currently. Well, some of them have their own tourist visas, but the way it's set up at the moment, you know, they come across to work. They also come across to take care of some administrative things and to do training. But we're working towards getting those guys to be able to go back and forth. The border there has been evolving pretty rapidly over the past couple of years. It was closed after 9/11. And just recently, a self-service port of entry was opened at the Boquillas Crossing. And the fire program and the Diablos program is still kind of just catching up to being able to get these guys back to the point where they can go back and forth like they were able to before 9/11.
Now, they don't always come over just when there are active fires, but also preventative work, controlled burns. What's involved and how often does that happen?
We have the River Cane burn program that was mentioned in that documentary that we listened to just a little while ago. And that happens on an annual basis. The Diablos have also participated in prescribed fires all over the Southwest.
So the River Cane, this is an invasive species, grows really rapidly and I guess is clogging parts of the Rio Grande River. So you just burn this and kill it? Is that the goal?
You burn it and then you do an herbicide treatment afterwards. After our recent burn, I went back a couple weeks later, probably 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks later, and there was already some cane that had come back, you know, 2 to 3 feet just in that short period of time.
Just amazing. So it's not about fire prevention alone, but a kind of preservation of an ecosystem? Is that what they're active in?
You know, there's multiple objectives in the River Cambourne. Fire prevention probably isn't one of even the primary ones in that particular program. It really has more to do with restoring sort of the natural hydrology of the river. The Rio Grande is prone to natural flood events, and all of that sedimentation in the past before the River Cane became established would get pushed downriver. And what that River Cane does is it holds on to that sediment and it channelizes the river in an unnatural pattern. And that's sort of the primary focus of it. And there's also the resource objective of trying to reestablish native species and wildlife access to the river, because that cane acts as kind of a impenetrable barrier. I mean, it's almost impossible to walk through it. I mean, even if you got a machete, it's almost impossible.
My guest is Richie Sinkovitz. He's crew boss of Los Diablos. That's a binational firefighting team that includes 32 Mexican nationals operating mostly out of Big Bend National Park in the south of Texas. The border is a political hot point. You know, there's discussion now of building a wall. People who oppose immigration and taking jobs from Americans are supporting immigrants, and budget cuts to public land. Have you had to defend having this team, this multinational team there in Big Bend?
Not to this point. You know, I mean, we're in a very rural environment. In our part of Texas, Brewster County, especially southern Brewster County, there's a lot of support, local support for this crew. I mean, these communities have been neighbors for a long time, generations and generations. And it's such a rural environment that the river, in many respects in our local community, is just, it's seen as a river. It's an international boundary, obviously, but, you know, our local support is very strong. You know, whenever we're passing through town in our bus, you know, people stop and thank us and support us. You know, I really haven't felt a lot of the national politics of the border, it doesn't necessarily reach us out in rural West Texas.
How about for Los Diablos themselves? They're getting paid in American dollars by the U.S. government. How much, by the way? How well do they get paid?
I mean, they earn the same as, you know, any other firefighter doing that work. You know, it varies depending on what particular job they're doing. They're what you call an administrative hire. So it varies, you know, between, you know, $15 and $25 an hour. But yeah, you know, I mean, they just get paid at a normal rate. You know, they're not full-time employees. They're considered sort of emergency administrative hires, and that's very common in the fire community when there is an emergency or a disaster where you hire these administrative hires who aren't normal federal employees to, you know, work in emergency situation.
So they'd get called to wildfires in other parts of the country?
Yes. Yeah. We just recently went to the Doghead Fire in New Mexico. The crew was out in 2013 at the Rim Fire in Yosemite National Park. They've assisted during Hurricane Katrina and Rita, also Superstorm Sandy. There was a small squad that went out there for emergency assistance as well.
I was reading an article about you all in Fusion, I think it was, and there's some problems for them sometimes withdrawing their money in Mexico because they get marked as fraud or trigger fraud alert.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that happens to me as well. You know, I'm currently in Mexico and, you know, it's a hassle, but we have really good relations with our local bank and they help us take care of that. You know, it's a hassle, but it's something that we, you know, strive to fix and minimize as much as possible.
Well, you've been working with this crew for some time, so it takes collaborative spirit. It takes, on some levels, you know, international spirit writ large. Is that part of your goal in running this?
Yeah, I mean, the international collaboration is one of the things that really attracted me to the program. I have a background with hand crews. I'm bilingual. I have strong ties to Mexico. And that spirit of collaboration is something I really like being a part of. Big Bend National Park has a long history of international collaboration and multiple aspects of the park management. There's international cooperation with CONAMP, you know, sort of the version of the Mexican Park Service on the other side of the river. And that extends to this river cane, you know, eradication operation and multiple other objectives, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's something that attracted me to the program. We also have really strong collaborative efforts with Customs and Border Protection. They help us maintain the credentials that allow the Diablos to cross and work. They've been a big part of maintaining this program, a huge part. And you know, interagency, international collaboration, it's one of the really nice aspects of this program. You know, it makes it more complicated, but also makes it more satisfying.
And how about having a good job like this, well-paying job for people who are living in a small Mexican town? How has this job changed the lives of these men?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a big deal. You know, these communities along the river, there's limited opportunities for income. Boquias, now that port of entry is open, it just celebrated its third anniversary. So there's an infusion of tourism money as more and more people who come to Big Bend bring their passports and cross over to Boquias for take short tours and, you know, and visit the town. But some of the other communities, San Vicente and Santa Elena, you know, they don't have that self-service point of entry, and they very much just rely on getting wax out of the Candelilla plant. And outside of that and ranching, there's really no income into the communities. So it's huge. It's a big boom for the community. It helps them just kind of, you know, eke out a very simple existence in a very rural location.
Well, it sounds like really hard but really interesting work. Thank you so much for talking with us about it.
It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Richie Sinkovitz is crew boss of Los Diablos. That's the nation's only International Park Service fire crew located in Big Bend National Park in South Texas. You'll find links to an article and that short video documentary of Los Diablos at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Some people will do anything for a decently paid job. Others make proximity to family or to nature the priority. Pam Pardee and Blair Gent left good jobs in Toronto and returned to rural Newfoundland to raise their young son. They soon found work there to be sparse. And now Blair, like thousands of other Newfoundlanders, commutes 3,000 miles overland to the oil sand fields of Alberta, splitting the family up for months at a time. Chris Brook brings us the story.
Brody. Time to get up, my baby.
Why?
It's 2:30 in the morning when 10-year-old Brody Gent opens his eyes to see his father with his bag packed, ready to drive to the airport.
All right, baby.
Brody lives with his parents in Harbor Mill, Newfoundland, a tiny community of just 182 souls tucked into the Atlantic coast of Canada. But his dad is going to work on the other side of the continent.
I'm Blair Gent, industrial mechanic.
With chronic unemployment in Harbor Mill, this quiet 39-year-old commutes all the way to Alberta, 3,000 miles away.
It's not so bad if you're young and got no family, but when you're tied down and got to pay the bills.
Blair's wife, Pam, and Brody slip in beside him for the three-hour drive up the coast to the airport, keeping their eyes peeled for any moose that might suddenly dart out of the blackness and cross the highway. After tonight, the family won't be together again for nearly 2 months.
Anybody who works in an oil patch, it's hard on family. There's lots of divorces. And 3 or 4 years ago, we were working just outside Calgary, and out of like maybe 50 guys, I think I was the only one left married.
Would you think of moving the family up to Fort McMurray?
Not a chance. Now, you know, scenario of every boom town, it's hard and fast, and there's a lot of hard elements, and family life is way better down here.
If you can call it family life, last year, Blair was away for 6 months straight. Right now, he's on a 6-2 rotation. 6 weeks in Alberta, 2 home with Brody and Pam.
Oprah had on it, for optimum health, you need to have sex 200 times a year. He's only home 40 days a year. So we're going to die early.
Okay. A quick curbside goodbye at the airport at 4 a.m. and Blair steps onto his flight to Fort McMurray. 8 hours from now, and he'll start his day installing instrumentation controls on the oil sands site. The maze of remote sensing transmitters that monitor things like pressure and flow rate for the oil extraction process.
You got everything ashore?
His nights will be a bunk in a company-owned work camp. Pam and Brody start their long drive back to Harbor Mill in the dark. Theirs is the flip side of Blair's long-distance job, making the family function while he's away. It's Pam Gent's work, and it starts now.
What?
What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong.
What is it?
Well, you know, just dropping your dad off. Kind of sad, don't you think?
Yeah.
You guess.
Is that all right? Is the one bag coming?
Back in Harbor Mill, Pam runs a small grocery store. It's the only store in town, but a tiny community with only 77 mailboxes can't give them enough business to make ends meet.
There's a lot of hope that the store will do better, so there won't be as much of a need for him to work away. But, I mean, right now, economically, we do need that money.
There's kind of a sad irony running underneath this work situation that Pam and Blair find themselves in. Up until 3 years ago, they both had dream jobs in Toronto, working 9 to 5, and the family was together every night.
Financially, it couldn't have been better. We had the big house and the big mortgage and the 2 vehicles.
But then, a couple of things happened. Back in Harbour Mill, Pam's grandmother died and left her house. And then, one day in Toronto,
I came home from work, you know, picked my son up from daycare, started supper, and on the news, it had this little girl was missing off a street, and this wasn't too far from where we lived. Even though I could see and hear my son outside playing from my kitchen, I just instinctively went in and grabbed him and brought him in and locked the door. And that was the very first time that I felt fear. And then the news just got worse. The next day, they found her body parts. She had been, it was horrible. So then we just made plans. We put the house on the market, and we were coming home.
Home to this little fishing village with a beach and a perfect swimming hole, a great place to bring kids up in. But
Blair has to work away. We keep thinking that the work away is a temporary thing, but this has been going on now since 2004 for us.
The Alberta time zone is 3.5 hours away, so the family stays in touch through voice messaging and phone calls in the wee hours when Blair's back in his bunk.
Hi, Blair, it's me. I just got home. So you make all of you get back, okay? Bye.
On Father's Day, it's 5 a.m. in Alberta.
Hello?
Hello, boy.
Hey, Dad.
How you doing?
Okay.
Don't forget what you gotta wish him.
Happy Father's Day, Dad.
Thank you.
Half-asleep phone conversations like this are often what the father-son relationship consists of while Blair's away. Pam works hard to make up for it.
I'm not going to pretend today's not Father's Day. If Blair was here, we'd probably do a beach bonfire. We'd have scallops. Scallops is Blair's favorite meal. We're doing all those things because I wanted to make sure that it's a special day for Brody and that he doesn't feel lost, because one of his little friends, his father came home on his 8-day rotation and happens to be here today for Father's Day, and that's Brody's best friend.
Here, I want you to wash your hair tonight.
I did last night.
Thanks for your help. You're really a big help. So where do you think Dad is? Tell me where the provinces
Alberta.
Are. Yeah, and what city?
I don't know.
Fort McMurray.
I've been with Blair since I was 16 years old. And the very first time that we lived together was on a single bed. And that single bed had room enough for 2 more people. We were that close. And that's how we slept for a lot of years, that close. When Blair started going away, you get used to sleeping on your own. And now when he comes home, he has a spare bed, and he goes out there. And actually, it was kind of funny, this time home, one of the first things he said to me was, "Oh, it's so nice to have my bed back." His bed is the spare bed.
Message marked urgent.
Hi, Z. Hope it does well. Give me a call later, okay? All right. Bye-bye.
End of message.
So I don't know. By the time we get content with having him back, he'll be gone. We'll be discontent with him gone for the first little time. Just as we get content again, he comes home, and then I have to accept him, and he has to accept me, and everything is jumbled up, and then the cycle starts all over again.
May I have your attention, please, for West Jet flight?
It starts over again at airport arrivals, with Pam dolled up in a low-cut sweater, holding a cup of takeout coffee for Blair. After an 8-hour flight, Blair appears in a fresh-pressed shirt, clean-shaven, smelling of aftershave.
This must be your come-home shirt, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. It's the only one clean.
The little things that show how much they welcome this part of the cycle. And Blair will be home long enough to paint the porch and fix the vacuum cleaner and maybe go fishing with his son. And then Pam will drive him back to the airport, and they'll each head back to their 2 separate worlds, home and work. Pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that should fit together, but don't.
Did you never call me today? I thought you were going to call me.
direct flight, 8 hours.
You said Calgary, I'm thinking.
Yeah, for 15 minutes, and then come on.
Chris Brooks there reporting from the series Working from Homeland Productions in collaboration with Marketplace Radio.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2014, Southeastern Asian cuisine, think Malaysian, Indonesian, Filipino, was the new it cuisine. That same year, Southern Mediterranean became a thing. Turkish, Moroccan, and Iranian dishes were showing up on foodie blogs and websites. Then Peruvian restaurants started showing up in cities across America. Missing among these culinary trends is one cuisine that writers and a few entrepreneurs have predicted is just about to hit the big time, Native American food. At a time when simple, back-to-the-land local food is decidedly on trend, why aren't Americans seizing upon the country's truly local cuisine? Emily Jury is senior associate editor covering education for The Atlantic, where she asked, why isn't Native American food hip? Emily, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So, as we said, several times over the past few years, food writers, bloggers, your magazine, The Atlantic, declared Native American cuisine as the next big thing. Why do you think it hasn't panned out?
They did declare that, and it makes sense. It's local and seems like it would catch on, but it really hasn't. And I think part of that is because people just don't really know what it is. And while there are some adventurous eaters who might want to try it, when you talk to landlords, they're looking for a sandwich shop or a pizza parlor that they consider a safer option.
And what is it? What is Native American food?
That's another issue. It's really hard to define. So people have lots of different ideas. People will think about things like buffalo, but salmon can also be Native American. It completely depends on the tribe, and there are more than 500 tribes in the U.S. So the central theme is it's very local. So foraging is big, and relying on local crops and herds is key.
I was in Washington, I guess, in the spring, and was urged to eat at the cafe at the National Museum of the American Indian there. And the food was very, very good. But I had no idea what to expect Native American food to be. So why do you think that hasn't been, I guess, branded earlier when...
Right. Branding is difficult. The way that that museum kind of got around that problem is they created different stations. So there are five or six different stations within that cafe, and each one kind of specializes in a different region. And they spell out for museum patrons what they can expect, but it's very much an educational process. There's a restaurant that's the subject of this piece in Denver called Tokabe, and Ben Jacobs, one of the owners, sees education as part of his mission. So he spends a lot of time, not necessarily on branding, but on educating the community and on talking to people who come into the restaurant. So not necessarily great for business, but he sees it as part of his mission to educate people.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Ben's entrepreneurial hopes for Tokabe.
So he partnered with one other man, and they decided, not quite a decade ago, that they were going to start this Native American restaurant. And Ben is part of the Osage tribe in Oklahoma, and he had grown up around restaurants. His parents owned restaurants, including one Native American restaurant. And he decided that he wanted to get into that. And he decided fast casual was the way to go. Denver also made sense. I mean, he was from Denver, wanted to stay there, but a lot of tribes were resettled in that area, so there is something of a Native American population there. And he decided he was going to open this restaurant, and he, quite frankly, had trouble finding landlords who were willing to rent space to him. So a few years ago, they said, yeah, we're going to expand. We're going to have, you know, 13 restaurants really soon. And, you know, 6 years later, that really isn't the case.
Fast casual, would that compare with like a Chipotle or sort of Panera?
Exactly,
kind of thing?
Exactly. And Chipotle is frequently the comparison that's used because Chipotle was also sort of started in Denver.
Well, I think a lot of people have an association with Native American food with fry bread, this idea of fried food, very heavy, very dense. So they wouldn't think it's a healthy alternative.
Exactly. And Ben will say, you know, you shouldn't eat my food every day of the week the same way that you shouldn't have a hamburger and french fries every day of the week. But occasionally, it's okay. And he does start with fry bread, which is controversial. It was something that many tribes consider survival food, where they were uprooted from their communities and it was sort of what they were given by the government in order to survive. And not all Native Americans think that fry bread should be preserved, but it is something that is common among tribes, and so Ben felt it was a good place to start. So he uses it a bit the way Chipotle would use a tortilla. So you can have a fry bread taco, you can have kind of a salad on top of your fry bread, you can have fry bread sort of with your meal, but it is pretty much the base of everything else at Tokabe. And then he looks to other ingredients. So they have buffalo, for instance. But that also brings up an issue of cost, because buffalo is so much more expensive than beef. And he has to pass some of that cost along to the customers, and they're not always receptive to that because it is kind of a fast casual restaurant.
Yeah, I was thinking that Chipotle, they don't necessarily source things locally. How much more does it cost to a sort of fast casual dinner when you're eating foods that are sourced locally?
It's difficult. And Tokabe, they've done a pretty good job of keeping the costs relatively affordable. I don't have the specific cost of say an Indian taco, but it was under say $12. So it's not outrageous. And while he does look for locally sourced ingredients, his priority is sourcing from tribes. He wants to support native communities. So he will bring in different goods, especially dry goods from around the country, as long as they come from tribes.
So how about from my limited understanding of Native American culture, which of course there's a huge variety within the tribes, there is a really distinct relationship between the food one eats and there's a sort of place in the cosmology for the food one eats. So is presenting Native American food in a kind of, you know, more fast food environment an anathema to the traditionalists?
In some ways, yes. And there was actually an interview with a Native American chef on NPR, and he basically said that restaurants aren't necessarily a part of Native culture, that's not something that's common. And so in some ways, there are these really innovative Native American chefs, probably across the country. We just don't know about it because they don't take their food into restaurants. They feel that it's more important to sort of stay with the tribe, to feed the tribe, to serve the tribe. And it's very much a communal thing, but it's not necessarily something that's shared widely.
So with chefs like Ben Jacobs who have a mission, a larger mission to educate people, do we have any good models of, education and food service at the same time? I mean, that's a lot to put on the success of a restaurant.
Right. It's complicated. And he started this very young. I mean, he was in his mid-20s when they opened Tokabe, and so was his business partner, Matt Chandra. And they really looked to serve the community from the outset, but it has been kind of an experiment. So he thinks, for instance, that it's really important to hire Native American workers. That's great, but a lot of them don't have restaurant experience, and he hires young people, so he might hire teenagers, and he spends a lot of time working with them. He also, and I thought this was interesting, he doesn't consider himself a chef, even though I would argue that he is. He sees his work as kind of preserving native food, and he asks his workers to bring in family recipes, and they spend a lot of time kind of testing those out and bringing ones that seem like they would be good sort of to the broader restaurant. But he also does things like offer scholarships for Native American students to attend college. And he does all of these different things, and that takes a lot of time away from running the business. And he would argue it's part of the business, that is part of his mission, but it's certainly not something that you see most chefs devoting significant time to.
So what do you think it would take, Emily Derry? Maybe a celebrity chef, well-known, embracing Native American food to give it a little bit more luster in the public eye?
Potentially, I think that could help, but I think that would also have to be done carefully, because you wouldn't want to give the impression that you were appropriating something that wasn't yours. And I think that Native communities are very proud of their food, but they also want to be the ones to preserve it and to share it, and sort of passing it off to someone else raises some questions, I think.
Emily Dury, she's Senior Associate Editor covering education for The Atlantic. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Her article in The Atlantic is called Why Isn't Native American Food Hip? You can find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. America got dark in the 1930s. The stock market crash and Great Depression, which followed, plunged millions into unemployment. Gang violence and crime surged, stretching the limits of law enforcement. The worst drought in U.S. history crippled farms, scattering desperate families across the country. But out of the darkness came a light. A new genre of fictional characters burst onto the scene. They captivated readers with tales of superhuman abilities, phenomenal strength, and noble quest to protect honest citizens from crime and evil. The comic book superhero gave fans goodness to cling to when everyday life felt impossible to bear. And that dependability has continued since the first costumed crime fighter knocked out evil with a kapow. Lisa Mignona is vice president and editorial director of Simon Pulse. That's an imprint of Simon & Schuster's children's books. She's also a passionate fan of comics, who edited and contributed to an anthology of essays exploring the love between authors and their chosen fictional heroes. It's called Last Night a Superhero Saved My Life. And Lisa Mignona, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you introduced this collection not as a book about superheroes, but instead our relationships with them. After looking at all these essays, what is at the heart of that bond?
I think a few things are at the heart of that bond, and one of them is the way we find ourselves in superheroes. And as a lot of the authors talk about, it's really the human in these superhumans that we're able to connect with, and then we see those humans being super. And it helps us feel that we all have the ability to be super one way or another. And also, because those superhumans are so deeply flawed, seeing the flaws and the super live side by side is such a wonderful sense of comfort and peace for, I think, many readers, to know that they're not mutually exclusive. I think a lot of people who are not as familiar with comics and superheroes assume that these are these perfect characters, when in fact they're so deeply imperfect, just as we are, and we see those imperfections and we can relate and connect, and then we can believe that if they can do the things they can do, we might be able to do those things ourselves.
Were there any common themes among the authors as to why they are drawn to the superhero?
I don't know about the why. I mean, certainly the what felt similar in many different manifestations or iterations. I think people did find themselves in those characters, because you would see from the different essayists, you know, Delilah Dawson wrote an incredibly powerful essay about her relationship with the Hulk, and she felt that she had this inner anger that she saw in the Hulk. And Jim DiBartolo wrote about Superman and how if Superman was this regular guy who was awesome, and Jim felt like he could be a regular guy who was awesome. So I think it's an interesting, fun thing if you ask people, you know, which is your favorite superhero, and it tells you a little bit about who that person maybe sees themselves as being as well.
Delilah Dawson is one that particularly hit me. She summoned the Incredible Hulk as she was surviving an abusive household, a rape, an attempted suicide. Is there, I don't know, a kind of loneliness, abuse, a desire to just transcend the normal that you found in these?
Definitely, definitely. And one of the other contributors, Leigh Bardugo, said something about how the powerless find comfort particularly in reading about characters with so much power, whatever it is that makes a person feel powerless, when you're able to read about someone else who could do what maybe you feel you can't do, it gives you more of a sense of that power.
It almost sounds like superheroes as self-help guides in some way.
I do think that that's actually part of it for many people. You know, when you read Delilah's essay, that's what you feel, is that for her, feeling that she wasn't alone, feeling that somebody else had found a way through making peace with his anger and used it to become stronger rather than weaker, which was very much what Batman was for me as well. I think there's a comfort in that again and a real inspiration.
Well, Batman shows up over and over again in the collection, and not surprising to you, as you you fess up that you had a Batman-themed wedding. Your mm-hmm. guest room is a shrine to the Dark Knight. How did you first encounter Batman?
So the first Batman, I guess the first medium I encountered in terms of reading or watching was the Tim Burton Batman movie in 1989. I was familiar with Batman as a character, the way many people in our culture are. But I had never really seen Batman's backstory and learned of the trauma and the tragedy that he experienced. So when I was 12 years old, I saw the Tim Burton Batman movie in the theater and watching on screen as he suffered this incredible tragic loss and seeing how he formed himself into something larger than life and stronger, and how he speaks repeatedly in the movie about how bats are great survivors and he's a survivor. And he's not looking to be a martyr, and he's not looking for everybody to thank him for what he does. He's just becoming something to protect other people who go through something like what he went through. And I was stunned and thrilled and so comforted.
So I want to dig deeper into that with this idea that Batman saved your life. So what do you become there? The person who borrows his courage and his flaws and knows that you can live with them, or looks to him to somehow, I don't know, pull you through? I'm trying. Can you distinguish that for me?
Yeah, I think it's really a mixture of both of those things. When we talked before about feeling alone and needing to feel that someone else out there had lived through what you've lived through, and while I never experienced the exact tragedy that Batman did, I had experienced a lot of loss, and I felt very alone and very afraid. And here was this man who had experienced trauma as a child, something that one could imagine would break a person. And he grew up and became so much stronger. And I was watching at the time my mother suffer from mental illness. And she was a single mother and I was an only child. So that was really my only example, or my closest example, of an adult. And I knew that she had experienced trauma. And while she was doing everything she could and functioning quite well, she was struggling. And so to see in Batman this representation of somebody out there who had been able to do what he could do, it definitely was an example for me of I can be like him. And there was also some level of mythological faith, honestly, of just feeling that Batman was out there and that he was protecting me.
Lisa Mignogna is with us. She edited an anthology of essays exploring the love between authors and their chosen fictional heroes, and wrote her own essay about Batman. The collection is called Last Night a Superhero Saved My Life. Well, there is another story here about definitely being trapped in the human. Very touching story by Anthony Bresnahan about a connection to Iron Man. Can you tell us about that essay?
Yeah, that's another one that really makes me cry every time I read Anthony's essay. It's a really beautiful essay that does explore very quintessentially how our vulnerability and our strength live together and go hand in hand. It's about Anthony's wife who grew up, she had a heart condition when she was young, and she had an older brother whom she looked up to, and together they really shared a love of comics, and Iron Man was a character in particular that she identified her older brother as being very much like Iron Man. And without spoiling the reveal of the essay or where things go in this essay, it does explore how when someone's weakness is their heart, and that's also their strength, because through that weakness, they can learn how to be stronger for the people around them, and how Iron Man as a character has a device that keeps him alive, that's something that nearly killed him, that also gives him great power.
Mm. Wonder Woman is also a repeated hero in the collection. There's an essay by Jodi Picou, New Hampshire's own, I might say. She wrote it originally for Playboy, but this was about her stint writing issues for the Wonder Woman series for DC Comics early in her career. Only the second woman to have ever done so. What does Wonder Woman mean to her?
Well, I love Jodi's essay, and I love that she talks about being a woman writing Wonder Woman, because I think, and I did also think what was interesting is that Wonder Woman was one of the two characters that had multiple essays in this book, because sadly, for most women, Wonder Woman is really the only major iconic superhero who is also a woman. However, people have different relationships with the kind of power she has and how she dresses. And so for Jodi, it was really meaningful to be a woman writing this woman character who had traditionally been imagined and written by men. And so Jodi really brought something special to her experience writing the Wonder Woman comics. And I love that she has this essay about being able to be a woman writing about this iconic woman superhero.
This whole collection of essays, it's broken up into these categories, you know, superheroes and being human, superheroes in childhood, but also superheroes and love. How did a relationship with superheroes help any of these writers translate joy and pain of love?
I love those essays too, because I think that speaks to the relationships that superheroes have and how we as people often find our own relationships in fictional relationships too. And we look to those fictional relationships as examples of healthy love or sometimes not healthy love. And we all, you know, many of our first crushes are on fictional characters growing up. And so I think, you know, Jamie Ford has a wonderful essay about losing his virginity and his first love. And he watched the relationship unfold between Daredevil and Elektra. And he found in his own relationship some ability to accept that you can have this great passion and this wonderful romance that maybe isn't going to be your lifelong partner, but still has a place in your life, very much as all of us Daredevil fans know that Elektra is always going to be pretty special to Daredevil.
For a long time, there was a kind of stigma about people who read and fantasized about comic book superheroes. But in reading the essays in this book, I think, you know, it's not all that different from, you know, reading Jane Austen novels when you were younger, you know, and expecting the Darcy or other treatments of fiction that presented something that was magical and outside of ourselves. Do you think that there is a kind of judgment against the superhero genre still?
Absolutely. And actually, part of the mission for this book was that we wanted to find a wide range of authors to contribute, some of whom are certainly known in the genre field and would be expected contributors. But also, we really wanted to find some authors that people might not realize. For instance, Jodi, who we've talked about. Many authors, many people don't realize that Jodi wrote Wonder Woman comics. It's not what she's known for. And Jamie Ford, again, Jamie Ford is an author who publishes adult literary fiction and might not instantly be someone's thought of who would be writing and caring about superheroes. And it was very important to me because in my life I have seen that these characters are deeply meaningful to a wide variety of people and they really cross boundaries. And, you know, I think right now, one thing that we can agree we need in this country is for people to cross boundaries and hear each other and listen to one another and appreciate differences rather than fearing them. And that's something that superheroes have always represented. At their core, these superheroes are telling stories about being alien and being other and finding acceptance. So it feels incredibly important for everybody to recognize that there's something intrinsic and universal here and not something that is often ghettoized.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your superheroes with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Lisa Mignogna edits novels for teens and tweens for Simon Pulse and is editor of a collection of essays called Last Night, A Superhero Saved My Life. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we mere mortals cannot play any tricks with time, so we're out of it for today. Thank you so much for listening. And besides, I am told I should be outside right now playing Pokemon Go, whatever the heck that is. I'm Virginia Prescott, back in the real world tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth, right here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.